The following is the second half of a public educational forum on the effect of marijuana on the adolescent brain. Sponsored by Laytonville Healthy Start, Ralph Cantor spoke first to students at Laytonville High School, then to a significant audience of concerned community members. Laytonville is in Mendocino County, California, in the heart of the marijuana-producing region called the Emerald Triangle. This presentation was recorded by Dan Roberts and is posted in 2 one-hour segments at www.youthspeaksout.net. This informative program is free to rebroadcast upon notification. This is part two.
I want to teach you a little bit about weed. This, I got a feeling a lot of people here do know, but you might not. Marijuana started with hippies in the 60s. Even though it was around forever, it really became part of the culture through hippies. When hippies started to smoke weed, let me back up a second. There's certain plants on the planet that happen to match something that goes on in the human brain. Example, a poppy plant. Not the poppy plant in California, but the poppy plant in Afghanistan and China. Okay, that poppy plant has a long stem, has a big bulb when it gets ripe, and these little flowers grow out the top. If you squeeze that bulb on the poppy plant, a white liquid comes out. And that white liquid happens to match something that goes on in the human brain. The white liquid is opium. And the human brain has an opioid site. So the human brain goes, oh, I know you, opium. Come on into my opioid site. And it does, and like a key into a lock, it can change the way the brain works. And it can change that opioid site. You follow what I'm saying here? By the same token, in marijuana is a drug. And the drug in marijuana is Delta 9. This is one of the drugs. It's the one that gets you high. Cannabinol. Better known as THC. And it turns out with this drug, you can't squeeze the drug out of the cannabis plant, but you can burn it. It needs heat to release the THC. But once you release the THC and you bring it into a human brain, the human brain goes, I know you, tetrahydrocannabinol. I do that myself. I have cannabinoid sites. And so like a key into a lock, tetrahydrocannabinol comes into a human brain, and then you take a PET scan or an MRI, and what you see is that after about 5 minutes of THC being in the brain, we got five sites that light up, three big ones and two small ones. These five sites are cannabinoid sites, and they resonate with the tetrahydrocannabinol, and the THC comes into these sites and change what it does. And when it changes these sites and what it does, somebody experiences being high on marijuana. Make sense? Okay. So let me just talk about the drug before I get into all the sites here. So this THC, when hippies started to bring it into the States, it came from Mexico. It was 1 to 3% THC. And I want to say that hippies got high. It worked. In Haight-Ashbury, in Greenwich Village where I live, they'd roll up a joint of THC, of weed, pass it around, and people would get high. The drug worked. That was 1965. Now things evolved. The first thing that evolved was Vietnam. And a lot of people went to Vietnam. I was one of them in Vietnam. And I did smoke marijuana in Vietnam. And I had I did it with somebody else, and we both said, what the hell is going on here? Something is really different. It just knocked our socks off. And the reason was, it was 5 to 10% THC. And if you do the math, and let's say this is 2%, and let's say this is 8%, this was 4 times stronger than this weed. It's kind of like in the States having a rum and coke, and then you go to Saigon and you have a rum and coke, except they put 4 shots of rum in it instead of 1 shot, right? So what they said was, and the reason for it was this. It was all cannabis, but the stuff that came from Mexico was cannabis sativa. where the stuff that came from Vietnam came from the Golden Triangle of Laos, Burma, Thailand, and that was a different strain of marijuana. That was cannabis indica. And so what happened was, when people started to come back from Vietnam, they thought, man, if we bring this indica back, we'll be able to make ourselves big bucks. And they were right. And so, and really, for a lot of them, the first step back from Vietnam was California, was San Francisco. They took those indica seeds, had them in their pockets. They weren't going to plant them in San Francisco. But up north, man, there's not a lot going on up there in Mendocino and Humboldt and Trinity and Siskiyou. It's just a lot of trees and a lot of land. And the weather ain't too bad. So they brought the seeds, started to plant them up here. And marijuana changed. This marijuana, what it was sold by, this is why it's good to be old in some ways, it used to be called a lid. And what it was is, you get it from Mexico, they break off a handful off of a brick, a kilo, and fill up a sandwich baggie. And the sandwich baggie weighed about an ounce, but it didn't even bother to weigh it, and it cost $5. And that was hippie weed, and it worked. Once they came back from Vietnam and started to grow the indica, marijuana changed from $5 an ounce to $5 a gram. And all of a sudden, marijuana stopped being hippie stuff and turned into big business. And it's never stopped being big business. I don't know if you know anything about drug dealing, but dealing by the ounce as opposed to dealing by the gram is a whole other level, okay? And so that changed the whole picture around marijuana. And then the competition started, and one of the main things that they did, and they started up here, was they, when the plant, when they first plant the crops, and a lot of you know this stuff, maybe not, I don't know, but you plant the seeds, you give it a little water, it gets a little sunshine, and after about 3 weeks, the plants get to be about this high. And when they are, you can begin to tell the difference between a male plant and a female plant. Turns out they have genders. So what the grower does is walk through the field and look at the male plants and dig them up and throw them away. And they can literally throw away half their crop. But what's left now is just the female plants. And if the female plants grow by themselves without a male plant around, then the female plants don't get fertilized by male plants. And if the female plant doesn't get fertilized by a male plant, then the female plant doesn't make seeds. And so the potency of the plant, instead of going into the seed, goes into the bud. They used to call it sensimilla back then. But it's just growing the female indica plants. That bumped this up to 10 to 15% THC. And the kids that I taught weren't born yet. Okay. Nowadays, the average marijuana that at least is here in Northern California, where I am in Berkeley, the kids call it a nickel bag, a purple bud, okay? It is 15 to 20% THC. And a nickel means it's $5 on the streets. And I wanna say, you take that little nickel bag of purple bud and you bring it to New York, Chicago, Texas, Florida, you can get $15 or $20 for it. The only reason it's so cheap is that this is where it comes from. And it is all over the place. This is a hell of a drug. This is not this drug. This drug really, really works, and it has quite a lot of power to it. It reminds me a little bit, I'll only use the metaphor a little bit, but it's kind of like in the 60s snorting cocaine, where now, if they smoke crack cocaine, there's a big difference between it just because of the potency. That's some of what we're talking about here. This is a hell of a drug. And I don't think that parents realize just how strong this drug is. Okay, so we bring this drug into the brain. Here, those places light up, right? This one here is the nucleus accumbens, and it fires off dopamine, okay? This one back here is a very interesting one. This one's called the cerebellum. And it turns out it's a cannabinoid site. And what the cerebellum handles is coordination. Not just how I coordinate my body, but also how I coordinate myself internally, how I coordinate my mind. I mean, like right now, it's 20 after 7. You guys had a whole day. Here's this guy doing lectures on a whiteboard about something. You know, and part of your book, man, I didn't want to go watch TV or watch the ball game or go to sleep or whatever. No, let me hang in here a little bit more. Maybe I have more to teach. In other words, you kind of focus in on what you're doing. That's what the cerebellum is doing, is kind of coordinating your mind as well as coordinating your body. All weed does to the cerebellum is slow it down. You smoke weed, and all of a sudden, those internal coordination things slow down. So I want to say something. If somebody is a little bit ADD, attention deficit disorder, got a lot of thoughts running around their heads, they smoke some weed, it eases that ADD. It slows it down. It hits that cerebellum, and all of a sudden, they feel like they can focus better. All of a sudden, things aren't racing around so much in their mind. You want to know something? It's true. The problem with it is when the drug wears off after 2 or 3 hours, then the kid becomes more ADD than they were before, because the brain is kind of reacting to it and bouncing back. So you do get relief for a while, but afterwards it makes it more ADD. Here, it fires off a bunch of dopamine, but then afterwards there's no reuptake, so you feel kind of burnt out, right? It works for the couple of hours, but then there's a price to pay on the other end. Watch this one, because this one is key for marijuana. This place here, it's called the hippocampus. And this is how I got into this thing, because I'm a teacher. That's what I do, is I work with teenagers teaching. What the hippocampus is connected with is learning. It's connected with memory. I'm going to draw a memory over here. But all of that, first of all, it's not just memory. It's all of your knowledge and experience, and it's located all throughout your brain. And everybody's got a ton of knowledge and experience. What the hippocampus does unconsciously, remember, this is the conscious part of the brain. Unconsciously, it does two important things normally. Number one, it's like an open Google search engine and pulls up from all your memory banks exactly what you need to know at any one moment in time. It is always doing it for you unconsciously. Let me give you three examples. Number one, marijuana makes your hair turn green. You smoke enough weed and your hair turns green. Okay, here's what I hope is happening in people's brains on this point. The hippocampus, everybody here, whether you smoke marijuana or not, has marijuana knowledge. You all know a bunch about marijuana. You follow? And so so your hippocampus is pulling up your marijuana knowledge as I speak right now, okay? So I say to you, marijuana makes your hair turn green, and unconsciously or consciously, you kind of go, what did he just say? I never heard that marijuana makes anybody's hair turn green. I never seen anybody's hair turn green. You're pulling up your marijuana knowledge right now. And so you kind of say, wait a second, that doesn't fit with what I learned. You follow how you're pulling that up? Here's a second example, unconsciously. You pick up an apple and you take a bite out of the apple. If the apple tasted like a banana, it would totally rock your world. I mean, it would freak you out. Can you imagine? You're talking with somebody, you bite into an apple and it tastes like a banana? What you do is you stop what you're doing. You look at the apple and you go, what the hell is going on here? Something is wrong. Something is really wrong. Why? Because your hippocampus is going, oh, check it out. We're about to have an apple. Is it a red apple? Is it a green apple? Is it a yellow apple? Oh, it's a green apple. Is it Pippin? Is it Granny Smith? I mean, you got apple knowledge that gets pulled up before you ever take a bite out of the apple. That's why you expect it to taste like an apple. Does that make sense? Good. Third one. Here's how it works in school. Teacher says, okay, class, I'm now going to start, you're now in fourth grade, I'm going to start teaching you about percents. You're ready to learn about percents. So I'm going to start by teaching you about 50%. What I expect in the student's brain to do, even though it's unconscious, is the student goes, okay, well, I know about parts of a number. I learned about fractions. I got fraction knowledge. So I pull up my fraction knowledge. I know what a half is. Not only that, but I got some decimal knowledge. I learned little decimals this year. I know what 5/10 is. And so the hippocampus pulls up all of this information that you have, and the teacher then starts teaching about 50%. That rattles around in the child's brain. And if the child gets it and says, I got it, now I understand what 50% is, the hippocampus does the second thing, which is it puts the new information into memory. It puts the new information into memory. The other thing that it does unconsciously, by the way, which is very interesting, and it does this more than anything else, is it trashes information. So that when you're walking around, what I said to the kids was, how many kids did you see in school today? Could you name them? And they could name a whole bunch of kids that they saw. And what were they wearing? Oh, I don't know. I don't know what they... And what's going on in the brain is the hippocampus is going, not important, not important, important, not important, not important, important. You get it? So it's kind of deciding what it's going to put into memory. This is basically the way we learn. This gets whacked by marijuana. This is a cannabinoid site. So watch what happens. It doesn't kill brain cells, but it does freeze them and make them not work well. What it does here is it makes the hippocampus not work well. So the first thing that happens is you don't pull up off a long-term memory very well. Watch what happens if you don't pull up off a long-term memory very well. You get stoned. And while you're high, you pick up an apple and you take a bite out of the apple. But you're not pulling up any of the long-term memory. So you bite into the apple when you're high and you go, oh my goodness, I may have had 1,000 apples in my life, but you gotta taste this apple, because this apple tastes special. It's kind of like I'm eating an apple for the first time. You listen to a piece of music that you listened to 100 times before, but you get high and you listen to that piece of music and you go, whoa, I didn't really notice that trumpet there before. I really didn't notice that beat there before. It's kind of like seeing the thing for the first time. It's a shift in consciousness. Have you ever seen people in San Francisco that are riding on the tour buses and they're leaning out and they're looking and you wonder, what the heck are they looking at? For them, they're seeing San Francisco for the first time. So for them, their consciousness is different. You follow what I'm saying? If you knock out this memory system, all of a sudden, it kind of frees you from all of those old memories, and all of a sudden, you can think outside the box. You're not locked in there anymore. And I have kids that'll say, oh, Mr. Cantor, it makes me more creative. I get high and we get into these deep conversations, you know, really deep conversations. And in the middle of the conversation, it's really deep. What was I talking about? I know I was talking about something real important. I just forgot what it was. It also doesn't put stuff into memory either. It interrupts this whole process. This is very interesting. I mean, it makes you, what I say to the kids is that when you were 2 or 3 years old, you might have gotten down to hands and knees and looked at ants, you know, but you were done with ants for a long time. Smoke some weed, knock this out, and you might go, whoa, look at the ants walking around. Wow, check out the ants. You getting the picture here? So part of that high is knocking this stuff out. So a whole, and there's a few more. There was a little one over here. That's the hypothalamus. That makes you hungry. That's one of the reasons why it has medicinal value. And then there's a fifth one here, which is the amygdala, which we're still really learning about. I'm not going to go into it tonight. But the three big ones are slowing down, firing off some dopamine, and knocking this memory out, so all of a sudden the apple tastes good and the music sounds good. Make sense? Here's the question of the day. After the high wears off, which is about 2 or 3 hours, how are those parts of the brain? The high's over now. And the big one for me as a teacher is, how's the hippocampus? Because I want people to have a clear hippocampus, because I'm teaching math and science here. They need to be able to process information, pull up what they know, put new stuff in. How long before this hippocampus comes back to full working order so that there are full students sitting in that seat again? And the answer, and kids, some of the kids that I work with back in Oakland, in Juvenile Hall, they all know this answer. Because when you get out of Juvenile Hall, you got to go see your probation officer every week. And the probation officer is checking on, you know, if you went to, you made all your classes and all that other kind of stuff. And they hand you a cup, and you got to pee in the cup. And then they test the pee to see if there's any drugs that are in your system. And what the kids in Juvenile Hall know is that if they drink alcohol, they do cocaine, they do whatever the drug is that they do, after it gets you high in your brain, the blood pumps it through the liver. And the liver filters out toxics. It filters out the intoxicants. And so it filters out all of the alcohol. It filters out all of those drugs. It goes into the kidneys. It filters it out. And by the way, that's the reason why the liver is the thing that goes for an alcoholic or a drug addict, because it just can't do it anymore. But it works very well. It clears it all out, gets through your kidneys, gets into your bladder, you urinate it out. In 24 hours, when you pee in a cup, it comes up clean. Your body is cleaned of all of those drugs, except for one drug. Actually, there's a couple that are weird, but the one drug that matters here is marijuana. Marijuana, if you smoke it, it'll show up in your urine for a little over 3 days. Little over 3 days. So, and the reason is that it stays in fatty tissue. Just like when you make an edible, you put it into butter because the butter is fat, so the THC will go into the butter. It also goes into the fatty tissue in your body, and most of that fatty tissue is not your butt and your thigh. Most of the fatty tissue is brain cells. The brain uses fat for energy and oxygen to burn it, okay? So it takes a couple of days to get this THC out of this hippocampus, so this kid is processing information the way he should or she should be processing information. So I wanna say something that I think is also, just like is marijuana addictive, here on this thing, marijuana interferes with learning. Marijuana, and I want to say something else here, is that if somebody's smoking weed more than every 3 days, every other day, let's say, or every day, then before that THC gets out of their system, they put more in. And before that goes out, they put more in. They smoke every day or every other day for a number of months. They won't come up with a clean urine analysis test for 30 to 45 to 60 days. It just lingers there, and it's not like any other drug. So my concern is that they are just, that doesn't mean that they don't learn at all, but they are just not very sharp. And that's my biggest concern as a teacher with marijuana. Marijuana interferes with learning, and this makes the high very interesting. It makes the apple taste good, it gives you know, all that. But at the same time, the price on it is you're knocking out that memory system for a number of days. And that's of a big concern for me.
Now, are you saying this is different in a teenager?
This is true for everybody. I mean, if the apple tastes good because you're not pulling up from the memory, I don't care whether you're 16 or 60, it's knocking this hippocampus out, okay? But what I am saying is it's not killing it. You're not killing brain cells. The hippocampus will come back, okay? But a lot of things aren't being integrated. And what I want to say about teenagers, I'm working at Berkeley High, it's so interesting with the parents. A parent will say to me, listen, my kid's getting A, B's, and C's. I don't care that he's smoking weed, okay? And part of what I say to the parent is that that is not all your child is learning. During teenage time, they need to deal with their feelings. How do I deal with frustration? How do I deal with all how do I deal with who I am and all these things about being a teenager, okay? Those things get interfered with. Those things they don't really work through. And I've seen it in 12-step programs where people who started using it at 15, they're now 25 years old, but they have the emotional development of a 15-year-old. Because they haven't integrated it, they haven't worked any of this stuff. They need to figure out how to do this stuff now. Questions? Yo.
I think I might know the answer, but is the effect of alcohol pretty much the same?
No.
Okay. Can you
yes. You know something, in terms of long-term effects, I just wanted to say something about weed. In some ways, it can be very difficult to see long-term effects. It's very interesting that just about 6 months ago, it came out of Duke University and Australia, and they did a 40-year longitudinal study around marijuana. This is the first one that's really 40 years of people that started smoking at 15, people that started smoking at 21, people that stopped smoking, you know, what was their experience all the way through. And one of the bottom lines on it was if somebody started smoking before 19, 18, 17, 16, 15, on down, they had a loss of IQ. So it does affect IQ in that way. At least we think that it does anyway. But it's not racking the brain the way alcohol does. Alcohol is a different ballgame. The way I explain alcohol is this. It's one way to think of it. I mean, back in the 30s, when they didn't have anesthetics, how did they pull somebody's tooth? They got them drunk, right? And then they didn't feel it as much. So you drink some alcohol, and what alcohol does is, yes, it fires off the dopamine in the nucleus accumbens, but the rest of it is it puts the outer layer of the brain to sleep. And when I put the outer layer of the brain to sleep, I get looser. I'm not so uptight. So things in here come out. That's why people like to drink alcohol. It's a good social oil thing, right? You drink a little bit more alcohol, and it puts a deeper layer to sleep. And now you don't walk so well because it starts to affect your motor stuff. You drink more alcohol, and if you put this deeper layer to sleep, you could possibly die. Because the brain is sending signals to the heart to beat, it's sending signals to the diaphragm to breathe. If we put any of that to sleep, you could die. So you can die from an overdose of alcohol. Usually what happens is somewhere in here, there's a trigger and you throw up. And throwing up is really a way of preventing you from overdosing on alcohol. But alcohol is a fairly simple drug in that kind of way, as opposed to this more complex cannabinoid site. I'll tell you my biggest concern with alcohol. It's not drinking and driving. That's the alcohol industry's biggest concern about alcohol. They want everybody to drink. Just drink responsibly and don't get behind the wheel of a car. But we want you to drink, okay? My biggest concern with teenagers particularly is that once you put these outer layers to sleep, a couple of things happen. For boys, boys got this testosterone thing going on, right? They got that there. And most of the time it's intact, all right? And they act like good gentlemen do. But you get them drunk, you get this a little bit loose, and it makes it much easier for whatever the impulses are here to come out more easily. And the other thing it does is once I put these layers to sleep, I become more vulnerable. And particularly if a girl and guy are drinking, the girl's getting drunk faster than the guy, both because she's smaller and she doesn't process the alcohol like the man does. So she ends up getting more drunk. She ends up being very vulnerable. And the guy now doesn't have a lot of inhibitions. And so it's a setup for a kind of a predator-prey situation. So my concern really around alcohol more than anything else is around sex and around the demeaning behaviors that teenagers do with one another when they're drunk. If you've ever seen a group of drunken teenagers together, it is one scary sight to see. Alcohol affects a teenage brain differently than an adult brain. Come on. Are adolescents more susceptible to alcohol than adults? Number one, teenagers have a reduced sensitivity to intoxication. What it means is that teenagers don't realize that they're as drunk as they are. Do you know what the alcohol choice is for teenagers? It's a 40. And for those of you who don't know what a 40 is, it's a 40-ounce bottle of high alcoholic content beer, like Schlitz malt liquor or something like that. So instead of it being 5% alcohol, it's 10 or 12% alcohol. And a can of beer is 12 ounces. So it's about 3.5 cans of high alcoholic content beer. I don't know about you, but I drink a beer, I can feel it. I drink two beers, I damn well can feel it. No less 3.5 cans of high alcoholic content beer. You want to know something? Kids can knock off a 40 or two. They don't recognize that they're as drunk as they are. Somehow or other, they don't feel it the same way that adults do. That's one of the reasons why kids binge drink. They don't feel it as much, even though they are very intoxicated. They don't realize that their sensitivity to intoxication is much lower than it is for adults. That's why kids binge drink more and drink more. And you want to know something? For the most part, they can hold their liquor better. They just don't get that they're as drunk as they are. Second thing, and increased sensitivity to social disinhibitions. What this means in English is that their inhibitions go down more than adults do. They are more likely to put the lampshade on their head and dance around than an adult is. Their inhibitions go down more. So now, for one, they're more drunk than they realize. Their inhibitions go down more than adults do. And number three, a greater adverse effect to cognitive function. They're not thinking either. And they're not up in the prefrontal cortex anyway. So now here, it interferes with their thinking, so they're not thinking. They're really, really drunk, and all their inhibitions have gone way down, so they are ready to party, okay? And it's a scary thing. This is different than adults. This is what concerns me about alcohol. They don't, it's a setup for accidents, it's a setup for demeaning behaviors, it's a setup for what I'm gonna just call straight away date rape, okay? That's what date rape is. I mean, it isn't that the girl was totally compliant or not, but in some way or other, she's put in that compromising position, and there's not a chance to be able to say no. Does that answer some of it about alcohol? And I'll tell you what was weird, really weird today, was that kids were at three classes. They asked me about cross-fading, which is that they're mixing alcohol with weed. And it's interesting, when I did a presentation at Tam High recently, and a kid said something to me very interesting. What he said was, you know how it works here at Tam High? The kids get high during the week. We smoke weed during the week. On the weekends is when we drink, right? Because you don't see kids walking to school knocking off a fifth of bourbon, okay? But you can see kids walking to school smoking a blunt, okay? And that's what the kids think also, okay? But now you crossfade them, you do both on there. It really isn't getting high anymore. What it is getting wasted. It's what the kids call getting wasted. I mean, it just kind of blurs you out. And it's fairly unpleasant. But the thing is that it's so available that they figure might as well do both. Alcohol in teenagers. A couple of little statistics. Number one, date rape. 1 to 2/3 of teen sexual assaults involve alcohol. Listen to this one. 18% of females and 39% of males say it is acceptable to force sex if the girl is stoned or drunk. She's asking for it. She's drunk, man. She's just kind of... I'll tell you the other one that really gets me around this. There's not a lot of drugs like this. But the other one, and I don't know how much it is up here, but it's in the Bay Area, is ecstasy. Okay? MDMA. And what ecstasy does is very interesting. It doesn't fire, it's the only drug, MDMA, the M stands for methamphetamine. And then the DMA is an interesting kind of psychedelic. And what it does is it affects emotions. What it does is it fires off in the brain an enormous amount of of serotonin. Not dopamine, but serotonin. So the feeling about being high on ecstasy is, oh, I have a tremendous feeling of well-being. Oh my goodness, it's all good. My heart is open. I love you all. I trust you all. This is a good thing, okay? This scares me. It's okay unless, you know, to be open and vulnerable like that, unless you're in a place where maybe all the people aren't quite that trustworthy. Or you're with a guy who's a nice guy, and the girl goes, I love you, I am open to you. It can tend to create a predator-prey situation. So between weed and alcohol, those are two that, between alcohol and ecstasy, those are two that really make me concerned around young girls as well. And this kind of statistic. Third one, 40% of children who start drinking before age 15 will become alcoholics. It's just a statistic, that's what they said. And lastly, in television, 9 out of 10 drinkers are portrayed as having no effects or only... what's the new movie that's out around being drunk? Hangover 3 or Being Drunk 7 or, you know, whatever. You know, and it's you don't see any down effects. Kids aren't seeing down effects off the media. It's all positive. Addiction. So I talked about addiction here. Wait, let me stop this for a second. And here's the thing that I want to say about addiction. more than anything else. What concerns me is how well the drug works. The better the drug works, the more I'm concerned about addiction. In other words, if I'm smoking marijuana and it takes care of my depression, I smoke marijuana, it takes care of my stress. I smoke marijuana, it takes care of my anger. I smoke marijuana, it takes care of my ADD. In other words, the more things that it takes care of, the more easily it is to get addicted. You follow what I'm saying here? In other words, and I'll have kids that'll say to me, man, this is my medicine. And I hate to say this, but what some people say in South, about Northern California, is that they all got the medicine. They all got the medicine, they're all using the medicine. So what does that mean? Is everybody here sick? And you're taking the medicine to get better? What's the story with the medicine here? And really what it's taking care of a lot of things. And the more things it takes care of, the more the child or leans on it. And the more addictive quality that it has. Does that make sense for people? Because it doesn't do the same thing for everybody. So how well does the drug work? Here's one other way that you can kind of think of this is how well the drug works. This is not the whole nine yards, but this is a good example. What this is a continuum, where on this side somebody is totally dysphoric, meaning that they're very, very unhappy people. Here, on this side, is euphoria. Here, they're really, really happy. Okay, and everybody is somewhere in between on this, not having much feelings at all, bored, feeling negative, I feel good, I'm interested, pleasure, okay? Now, if you have someone who is somewhere over here on the scale, good person, pretty good shape, and they smoke some marijuana, what it does is it bumps them up to a pleasure place, right? But watch this, if you have somebody here that's a pretty unhappy person for whatever reason, and they smoke marijuana, and it bumps them up to the same place it did the other person. Do you see the difference in the bump between here and here? So for this person, it worked much better than it did for this person. So this person is more likely to get addicted to the drug than the other person. Does that make sense? But it isn't just in terms of pleasure, it's in terms of a lot of things of how well that drug works with that person. So, messages for parents, what this is people pushing mud around, okay, because it's not easy. And remember, what I'm saying on this stuff is that the most important thing is the connection with your child. That's really what it's about. You want to be able to share and to be able to feel in that limbic brain, hey, we got a connection here, I know that that's there. Beyond that, here are some things that I want to say. Number one, be open to learning. I think the kids have something to teach you about weed. Tell me about it. What's going on? What's happening? Let me teach me a little bit here to be open to what's going on. Because in the kids' reality, they're surrounded by marijuana. We are not necessarily surrounded by marijuana, but kids come to school, it's all over the place. So it's not easy to be able to turn it down all the time, especially when it becomes a norm there in some way. So you want to hear what's going on. Here's the second thing. What you say and what position you hold influences your child's thinking and behavior. And I don't think parents realize this. The kid will never say to you, oh, thanks, Mom, for informing me about that. Now I know so much more than I did before. Thanks a lot, Mom. They are not going to do that with you, okay? But I'll tell you, as a counselor and listening to kids talk, what you say really matters. They really hear you. They're watching you and they're listening to you. They're not giving you the feedback. They're not going to tell you what's sinking in. But let me tell you, what position you hold and what message you give to your child does influence that child's thinking and behavior more than you might think. The clearer you get, the better off everybody is. So in other words, when you have the conversation, whatever your concerns are, so long as you're clear on what you're talking about, it makes the situation better. There's more trust that builds up there. Assess your child's propensity towards drugs and alcohol. Number one, in your family, do you have alcoholism or drug addiction there? You know, what all that is in one person's brain It's just firing off a whole lot more dopamine than somebody else. That's all that's happening. You go to a 12-step meeting and you talk to alcoholics or drug addicts, and what they'll say is, man, the first time I drank, it was like the world opened up. It was, you know, it's like an epiphany. Some people will say that about marijuana as well, okay? You want to find out, your child says to you, hey, I smoke some weed. First thing I want to say, what a gift. What a gift your child shared with you that they smoked some weed. Wow, that's a good start on stuff. Then what do you do? Part of what I'm suggesting that you do is make an assessment as to where is this kid at with the weed. Does the kid love it? So what I might say is, what was your experience when you smoked it? What did it feel like? What was going on for you? To be able to get into a dialogue about this stuff rather than freak out or take some position that you can't hold. Or you're just going to lock yourself into. You want to have a dialogue around this stuff. This stuff is not simple, and it's totally part of your child's life today. So, and you want to find out, how much did you like it? What do we have, alcoholism or drug addiction in our family? Do you have more of a propensity towards it? Because a lot of kids smoke weed and go, that's fine, no big deal. Got a lot of people that drink alcohol, enjoy a couple of drinks, no big deal. And for other people, it is a big deal. And so part of what you want to do is make some of that assessment with your child. So, if you're going to give a message, here's the message that I would like for you to give. And the message is, wait. Would you please wait? Your brain is developing at this point. Wait. If you're interested in this stuff, just wait a while. And here's why I want you to wait a while. Number one, safety. Kids getting drunk, kids doing drugs, it can get pretty scary out there what goes on. You want your child to be safe. And part of that is, I need you to need your mind, and nobody's going to invade your body here. You know what? I need you to be taking care of yourself. Another reason is prefrontal cortex less involved. They do not have the sophistication to drink. And I know that some parents will say, well, I'm going to run the parties at home. That way I'm going to teach the kids how to drink responsibly. It just doesn't work like that, okay? They are just not up there. They don't have that sophistication. Number three, pruning and myelination. Your child's brain is growing, it's developing, right? Things are dropping away, things are getting myelinated in. This is a developing time for your brain, not now. Altering the pleasure center. Part of what it's doing, that pleasure center is our drive. It's our motivation. If I begin to dull it out, I begin to dull out a lot of motivation. You know that if you take the pleasure center, the nucleus accumbens, out of a rat's brain, so it doesn't fire off any dopamine, and you put the rat in a cage, and you put cheese in the cage, the rat dies of starvation. There's no reason why the rat would want to eat the cheese. Why should I don't get anything from it. Why should I bother to eat the cheese? So this dopamine thing, this pleasure center, is a very important thing, especially when they're first growing up. They need to figure out what it is that triggers that for them. Short-circuiting developmental tasks. You need to figure out how to party with your friends. Because right now, all you think of when I say party is drugs. Drugs is not what, but partying is having a good time. Remember when you used to be 9 and 10? I think of my boy shooting Nerf guns at one another and playing with doll and having a great old time. Okay, now you're 15. How do you enjoy one another now? This is something that you got to figure out. How do I have fun with friends? How do I deal with stress? What do I do to get interested? How do I do it? I have all those developmental tasks. The weed short circuits those developmental tasks. They don't have to do them anymore. All they have to do is get high. And lastly, the research. And I want to take just one piece of research here, and that's this one. And what this is they have a whole bunch of this stuff around alcohol and all sorts of drugs, and they have a ton of graphs. And in one way, it's always the same. On the bottom is the age. When did they start using the drug or using the alcohol? And on the vertical line is what's the problem with it? And on every one of these graphs, what you see is that, you know, the younger they started, the more the problems will be later on. Does that make sense? Right? Right. The prognosis is the longer, the earlier they start, the worse the prognosis. What you see on every one of these graphs, and I've looked at so many of them, between 17 and 18, there's always a big, big drop. And so what I want to say, even though it's not politically correct, you're supposed to ask kids to wait longer, if we can at least wait until between 17 and 18 before you start using the drugs and playing around, the prognosis of you getting harmfully involved goes way down. The biggest thing in all this drug stuff is the longer you can delay initial usage or initial involvement, the better off that child is. So that, it's because of all these reasons that I would like you to give the message, I want you to wait. And even though the kid might shine you on and still get high on the sly and hide from you with it, it makes it more difficult. And they got that in their mind. My parent doesn't want me to do this. They're concerned because they're concerned about my brain and they're concerned about this stuff. I know that that's there. I'm going to smoke. Okay, that may be true. But it sure interferes with a lot of it, okay? Even though the child is still doing it on the side, they are not doing it as much. If you can at least say to them, I don't want you to smoke, and here are the reasons why, it has an effect on your child, a very positive effect. So talk to your child. Here's my quick and dirty on this. Here's a way to do it, I think. First thing, I love you. You're my boy, you're my girl, you're my main person here, okay? Here's what I see. I mean, I'm looking at these statistics. You're walking through fields of marijuana all the time. It's all over the place. What do I feel? It scares me that you're exposed to these drugs, okay? And then, shut up, okay? Then have a dialogue. But it's, I care about you. This is what I see. This is how it makes me feel, and then go from there. But these, all these I messages, and then listen, then get into a dialogue on this. Second thing, to have some clear expectations. To say, listen, I don't want you using until you're 17 or until you're 18. I want you to wait. Ongoing communication and monitoring. This is not a one-shot deal. This thing around weed up here, it must come up in the newspaper and everything all the time. There's many, many opportunities to talk about marijuana. Use them and to talk about other drugs. The monitoring, here's the deal for me, and I love this. This is a parent that said this to me a while back when I was doing this talk. She said, I'll tell you what I do. I got a 17-year-old boy, and on Saturday night, he's got a curfew. I don't remember, it was 12 or 1 o'clock in the morning. But when he comes in, I'm up. And I always love to say to him, come here, I want to give you a hug and a kiss. Okay? And she says, I take the kid and I give him a hug and a kiss and I smell him and I look at him. I want to know what's going on with my boy. Okay? So that you should be monitoring in some way what's going on with your kids. And if they're going to somebody else's home, what's going on there? Is there an adult there? How about this? You think they might have a loaded gun in the house there somewhere? Or, you know, what's going on there? I want to know. My child is 15, 16, 17. I want to know what's going on there. I want to make a connection with the parent. I need to monitor my kids. Next one, integrity and self-assessment. What that means is you got to get to a place where it feels right for you to be able to express what's on your mind. You need to have you need to do some self-assessment in terms of your own drug stuff. But I want to say this one that I think is unique about up here. If I was up here as a teacher, first of all, I wouldn't be making as much money as I do in the Bay Area as a teacher. Make a hell of a lot less, right? So I might consider growing a few plants on the side. Get an extra $5,000 or $10,000 for my family for the year to make up for that stuff. It's not, you know, it's not that big a deal. I want to grow a few plants here. It does not necessarily have to then compromise you in how you talk to your child about this stuff. Think about it a minute. And so I did an alcohol community meeting in St. Helena. It's a real wine-growing town. So here are all these people that have these wineries that are growing all this wine and alcohol, and you know what? They don't have any problem saying to their kids, I don't want you drinking alcohol. And it's not hypocritical. You're too young to drink the alcohol right now. Your brain is not ready for the alcohol right now. Not now. You gotta wait. I don't care that I'm growing wine here. That still doesn't give you permission to smoke. And I don't see why people who are growing some plants feel so compromised that they can't talk to their kids and say, it's not for you now. Or feel like because they're smoking some weed that somehow or other it compromises them that they can't say to their kids, I don't want you to smoke weed. It is not hypocritical. Can you sit and have a margarita and say to your 15-year-old, I don't want you to have a margarita? Absolutely. Why can't we do that with weed? It's a really interesting thing. Somehow or other, this weed thing seems to compromise us in different ways. And it was interesting because I had a conversation with somebody today about it, and they were saying, well, you know, if you're growing weed here, it's got to be on the down low, and then you feel, you know, like you're doing this kind of stuff. You need to be able to not feel compromised about what you think about your child smoking weed. Whether you smoke it or grow it doesn't mean that you can't say to your child, not now. Any more than a wine grower has a problem saying to their child, not now. That's what I'm talking about by integrity, where people can feel. So I feel like this is what makes sense to me. And the self-assessment piece that I want to say here is that we all as adults have to look at our relationship with drugs and alcohol. We have to look at our, and really look at it. And you know what the research says now? If the kid says to you, well, did you smoke weed in high school? What do you say? Okay, so it's interesting. You know what the research says now? You tell them the truth. You tell them the truth. Doesn't mean you gotta spill your guts. You know, this. But to be able to say, yeah, I did. But if you're gonna go there and do that, then you need to have a number of conversations with your partner or somebody else about what's the story around that. So you can have a conversation with your child that doesn't feel like you're out of integrity when you're talking with your child about this. But it's very important for you to feel like you are in integrity, because if you're not, the kids pick it up like that. Teen-proof your home. You know when the kid is a toddler and you gotta plug up the socket so they don't stick their finger in there, or you gotta put the hooks on the doors or whatever? You toddler-proof the house, right? So the kid ain't gonna get into stuff. When you have a teenager, I wanna make a couple of suggestions. Number one, if you have marijuana, it should not be out. It should not be all over the place there. The kid should not be able to have access if you have marijuana. If you have alcohol, put it away too. It does not have any place to be put out there. Even if your kid doesn't drink, you have other teenagers that are coming in the house. Do you know what the highest drinking rate is in Alameda County? Or you probably don't know Alameda County, but in it, the highest drinking rate is a town called Piedmont. Piedmont is one rich community, the highest alcohol rate. And part of the reason for that is that people leave their alcohol out. You know, for some people that actually in Piedmont, some of them have wet bars in the basement. So I say to them, listen, if you have a wet bar in the basement, take out a big crystal bowl and fill it full of marijuana buds. That way the kid can have a choice as to whether they want to drink or they want to smoke marijuana. Okay, otherwise, put the alcohol away. It's not appropriate for it to be out there. So one thing on teen-proofing the house is putting the alcohol away. The second thing is your drug cabinet. When I had my tooth pulled or I had stuff going on with my back, I got some Vicodin, okay? I used some Vicodin and the rest of it I kept. I want to hold on to some painkiller in case I really need it at some point, right? And so in people's cabinets can be a lot of other drugs that are there. You know what the third most abused drug is by teenagers? Alcohol, number one, marijuana, number two, and prescription drugs, number three. The kids know what Vicodin is and a lot of these other drugs. You should take the drugs that are in that are prescription drugs and put them away. Do not leave them in the medicine cabinet. Even if your child doesn't do it, other kids that are coming in there are opening the medicine cabinet. So teen-proofing your home is to put your alcohol and your drugs away and to take the stuff out of the medicine cabinet. Those are two simple things to be able to do. Last thing around the stuff is you want to encourage your child's connection, not just with you, but connected in the world and social skills. These are the two biggest factors, what we call protective factors for not getting harmfully involved with drugs. Number one is they're connected. They can be connected with church, connected with their family, connected with school, clubs. The more things that they're connected with, the better, the less that they're likely to get harmfully involved with drugs. And the other one is social skills. Social skills is really a big deal. When I was in eighth grade, I remember in the gymnasium, that they had us line up, the girls on one side of the gym and the boys on the other, and then you had to walk directly across. You couldn't go to that girl, you had to walk directly across. And then they said, okay, now take the girl, and you put your arm over here, and you put the other arm up here, and then she holds you there, and then you do, and they taught me how to dance. Okay, they taught me how to do the Lindy. Okay, and they taught me how to do a foxtrot. That's what was happening back then, right? I go to a party, I could dance. I didn't have to sit there like an idiot and try to figure out what to do. I had some skills. I wish they would have taught me how to talk to a girl. That would have been terrific too. But those skills really helped me to move in the world. Social skills are incredibly important to get and be able to do things in the world. These are two big prevention factors. When you look at drug curriculum, a lot of the drug curriculum is around teaching social skills. And the one social skill that I don't think is as big a deal is the one that says teach people how to say no. You know, in some ways, you learned how to say no when you were 2 years old, you know, and you got pretty good at it, you know. So it's more around connection and social skills. Prevention factors, the support of family, that you're spending time together, non-using peers, youth are connected to schools and activities, social skills. How do I deal with stress and celebration? They are looking at you. You come home from work. How do you kind of switch gears? How do you kick back? Do you pour yourself a glass of wine or two or three or light up a little bit? Then that's what the kids are seeing. They need to be able to see how you deal with stress. Maybe you exercise, I don't know what you do, but they need to have a positive role model around stress and a positive role model around celebration. If every time you get together, it's a big drinking fest or whatever, then that's what they see as the way we celebrate. You need to model, you guys need to figure out how do we celebrate without drugs necessarily or not having it be the center of stuff, and how do we deal with stress. So in your toolbox, you need to talk to other people about this stuff. You need to take care of yourself on this stuff. Get your act together. I don't want to go through that. Last piece. Let me do this piece. And this piece I got a chance to do with one or two of the classes, and I thought it was a great way to, we're done, huh? This is a great way to end it. The Wizard of Oz. The reason I use it is so many people have seen The Wizard of Oz, right? We all know it's about this girl, Dorothy. It's interesting with the tornadoes in Oklahoma. Got this girl, Dorothy, that got blown away from her home in Kansas and ends up in this strange land, this land of Oz. And here are these little munchkins. And she says to the munchkins, I want to go home. I want to go back to Kansas. And the munchkins say to her, I don't know how you get back, but if anybody knows, it's the wizard. And the wizard lives in the Emerald City in Oz. You just follow this yellow brick road and it'll take you to the wizard, and maybe the wizard will get you home. And so she goes on the road, and the first thing she runs into is a scarecrow who doesn't have a brain. I want to be able to have a brain. I want to be able to think great things and do great things. I want to have a brain. She says, I don't know how you get a brain, but they tell me that the wizard might be able to get you home. Maybe the wizard might be able to get your brain. Come with me. And so now the two of them are on the road. They run into a tin man, don't have a heart. Oh, I want to be able to love, I want to be able to be connected to people, I want a heart. We don't know how you get a heart. Maybe the wizard can get your heart, come along with us. And the last one they run into is a lion, doesn't have courage. I'm a lion, I want to be able to go out in the world and have courage. We don't know how you get courage, but maybe the wizard can come with me. So here are these beings on this road to get a heart, to get a brain, to get courage, to get home. It's a metaphor for people getting a life, right? They get to the top of the hill, if you remember in the movie, and they look down and there's the Emerald City. Then in between is the whole thing with the monkeys. Forget the monkeys. I don't get the whole monkey thing, I really don't. And you can't show little kids the Wizard of Oz because the monkeys are so scary in it. Anyway, forget the monkeys. They look down and they see the Emerald City, but between them and the Emerald City, if you remember in the movie, was poppy fields. And for those of you that don't know, poppy fields have opium. It fires off an enormous amount of dopamine, right? It actually, if you look at the movie, I saw it again recently, it starts to snow. It's kind of interesting. And they go off into the fields, they go off into the poppy fields, get a big smile on their face, and they go to sleep, okay? And what happens at the end is Glinda, the good witch, comes along and says, listen, you want to get a brain? You want to get a heart? You want to get courage? You want to get home? Get the hell out of the poppy fields, get on the road, and go to Oz. And there's a way in which teachers, parents, all of us, we need to be a little bit like Glinda and watch out that these kids don't get lost in the poppy fields, because they are walking, I guarantee you, they are walking through poppy fields. They're not poppies, they're marijuana buds. But let me tell you, they're all over there, okay? And these kids are walking through it, so it's necessary for us as adults to make sure that they don't get lost over there. And so that was the last message that I was able to give to kids, and I'm gonna shut up.
This concludes a public educational forum on marijuana and the adolescent brain. The speaker was Ralph Cantor of Berkeley, California. This was recorded May 22, 2013 in Mendocino County by Dan Roberts and is posted at www.youthspeaksout.net. Ralph's presentation and this recording were sponsored by Laytonville Healthy Start. For further information or to purchase CDs of this recording, you may contact us through the website www.youthspeaksout.net or check out on Facebook Laytonville-Healthy-Start. Thanks for listening.